Welcome to Let's Talk About Tests Baby, a weekly podcast about software testing, QA processes, agile, and other general geekery. My name's Jem Hill, and I'll be your host. Listeners, hello, welcome to episode 44. And I was feeling a bit sciencey when I wrote this, so let's talk about the scientific method. As I've mentioned, I have a biochemistry degree, so quite sciencey, and I like to apply this to testing. So, and we all use scientific method, like literally every person alive, especially testers, whether we realise it or not. Because the basics essentially are, oh, this is odd. Did this happen because of this? Test that. Update your hypothesis based on that. Keep going until you've nailed it down as much as you can that A definitely causes B. Done. That is the scientific method in a nutshell. And as testers, generally speaking, we find a thing, we figure out what causes the thing, maybe, and we keep going until we've nailed down what causes the thing. Sometimes the devs do that, but ideally we'd have a basic cause and effect. We kick that over to the devs, they fix it. We know what the deal is. We know what actions trigger what effects. But we can go deeper, listeners. We can go deeper. Because as testers, we can't prove there are no bugs. We can only say that we've not discovered or encountered any, backed up with the evidence of the work that we've done. Now, chances are you may have found some bugs, in which case you need to gather the evidence of the bugs that you found, and maybe use that evidence to advocate for those bugs being fixed. Not all bugs will be fixed, or even can be fixed, without breaking something else or changing how things work in a way that it no longer meets the needs of the client. So you have to make a decision, as well as what makes sense technologically and in with the budget, and we need to choose what bugs to fix on the basis of what will be most useful to the people who will be using the system, whether that be end users or the client. And the way that we gauge this is by using the evidence about the bug that we've gathered. So the first step is, once you think you've got a bug, is information gathering. Because sometimes it's easy, and if you know the system and the domain, you may know what the bug is just by seeing it. You know, an error message that you know, a permissions issue, fairly obvious stuff. Or you may have to do some digging to find out the details of the bug, steps to reproduce, things like that. At the minimum, I like to include reproduction steps, what I expect to happen, what actually happens, and screen grabs if appropriate. If I need to put my reasoning down as to why I expected something else, like if it's not really obvious what should happen, but I expected something different to what the devs have made happen, then I'll put that reasoning down. And that's essentially findings and justification as to why I think this bug should be fixed. Then you make a decision on whether the bug should block the story or not. Then this goes to the devs, and if a conversation is needed about the bug, it can happen with all the information documented in hopefully clear and helpful manner, which means they can familiarise themselves with the bug before having this conversation. I'm not just springing stuff on them. The exception to this is if I'm not actually sure if the bug's a bug, or if I'm genuinely unsure about if it should be a blocker or not, in which case I may talk to the dev first in person and then go from there. Sometimes we might even bring the project manager or the client on board if we need extra input. So that's the basics down. But what else can we learn from the scientific community with regards to testing? Let's talk about peer reviews. So scientific papers go through peer review before publishing. The idea is that work is independently reviewed by other scientists in the same field before it's published, or in this case, deployed to live. And then the world gives feedback, which would be UAT or post-live bugs in this case. If I can put a little verbal asterisk here, in that if you are interested in the issues with scientific peer review and with science in general when it comes to publishing papers, Ben Goldacre does a lot of work and writes a lot about the issues that we have with peer reviews and scientific papers being fudged and things. So if you're interested in that from an actual science point of view, Ben Goldacre. Start with his blog or his site, Bad Farmers, a book that he's written. Incredibly interesting and infuriating stuff. back to peer reviews in the context of software development. So, code reviews, in a way, is kind of like the independent review, because it's by another dev who can give the idea of constructive feedback before it's merged into the code base, and then it's passed on to us for testing. So in a way, it's kind of two different review steps. There is one section of the modern scientific hypothesis proving lab-based process that we deviate from. Well, there's many, but there's one main one that we deviate from as testers, especially if you're sort of like an exploratory tester and stuff, and that is plans. Because I've done experiment design, and it is a pain in the ass, listeners. There's so much you have to do, even with all the tables and stuff you can get now. A lot of work still goes into there, from figuring out your sample size and your statistical significance levels, your p-values against the null hypothesis, your confidence intervals, which are all ways of determining the level of confidence that you need to be able to prove that what you're seeing is an actual thing and not chance. And you've got to lay down your methods and what you're looking for. And it's all this has to be done before you start, because you need to work out sample sizes and things. It's a pain in the ass. I've done it. And I've done it at a really basic level. I did it for my dissertation at uni. I haven't gone into the professional sphere and done it, because I got out of biochemistry the minute I graduated, essentially. And then decided to grace the software testing world with my presence. You're welcome, guys. You're welcome. But yeah, as I said, none of this is really done outside of a lab. Even a formal test plan isn't going to be as rigorous as it needs to be for this kind of experimenty hands-on science. So, especially if you're exploratory testing, which you might have a framework, but it won't be like properly rigorous. But that's not to say we don't really have a plan, because we do. I mean, I use acceptance criteria plus my knowledge of the system and the feature I'm testing. Any feedback or results I get as I'm testing, we know the areas that have the most risk, we can focus on those. If I don't feel I know the areas with the most risk, I'll get a developer to sit down and talk me through the feature so I can run a few ideas past them, try to get some input. And at the end of the session, because you can review the notes of the things that you've tested, and then go back and do further testing if you think you've missed a bit, or if you want to investigate some risk more. What happens, essentially, is that we build the robust plan as we go along through the testing process, and we can build to it and add to it as we go, because we may start with just the framework, but we end up with a full test plan and execution report to use as evidence to support our hypothesis, which is we can't find any bugs in the system that we are testing. Because, as I said before, we can't definitively say, without any doubt, there are no bugs. We can just say, we haven't found any. There's bound to be some somewhere, but they're going to be little things, hopefully. Or it's going to be stuff on a context that we don't have access to, hopefully. And we can use those reports, first of all, to show that we've done testing and how we've tested it. And that might be useful to go back during retrospective, say, and if something does come up later, you can see where you missed it and things like that. It can be useful to show the clients, because they might want to see it. We've had clients want to see our test reports, or they might want to see how best to go about testing it themselves using that sort of data, or to know what we've done so they can test other things. So they don't want to recreate our testing necessarily. They want to do their own different devices and stuff. And there you have it. The basics of the scientific method and how science is used as applied to testing. There are deeper things. You can go even deeper, listeners. There are so many layers. But that is stuff that is quite complicated and that I can't remember from my degree, because I finished it almost 10 years ago. So let's not go there. But I enjoy the parallels. It also makes me feel that I'm not entirely wasted my education, which is nice. I also think that my love of science and the skills that I learned from that means that I'm quite good at writing user documentation, because I know I can write down steps to get where you want to go very clearly, because I always had to. And there seems to be a lot of people who have done a science degree who have then gone to testing, so there's clearly something there. It's very useful, and there's clearly some kind of connection there. Maybe someone should do a study. So I'm going to wrap it up here, listeners. Thank you for listening. I will see you all next week. As always, comments, feedback, criticisms, urges to collaborate, contact me. Contact details are on Let's Talk About Test XYZ. You can find me on Twitter at Let's Talk Tests. Email letstalkabouttests@gmail.com. Feel free to reach out for anything. And as I haven't asked for ages, if you feel the need to review on iTunes, that is always helpful. Bye!